said that 60% of Americans were felt uneasy about the economy. But if you raise your hand and you're optimistic, you unequivocally have the numbers on your side. I mean, it is an overwhelming case for a great economy right now. We're clipping along at 3.5% to 4% GDP growth rate. You'll notice that every time we have a reporting of the GDP growth rate, it gets revised upward by about a half point a few months later. That has been the trend since coming out of the recession in 2001 and 2002. Unemployment's fallen below 5%. It's at 4.9%. Home ownership is at record levels. The long-term interest rates are at 40-year lows despite the Fed's best effort to bring them down through short-term interest rate hikes. Productivity continues to amaze us. We're seeing numbers that over a sustained period that we haven't seen since the late 19th century when the U.S. rose from an agrarian nation to become the most powerful economy on Earth. So this dichotomy out there, I think, is very interesting that the majority of people, and particularly after Katrina, the numbers are probably about 70% feeling negative and only 30% positive. It's a dichotomy that kind of baffles the imagination, but I'll tell you one thing. It creates a great investment opportunity. If you look over the last 15 years, when was the time to be in the market? It was exactly the time when the sentiment was bad, but the numbers were trending upward and were good. One of those situations existed in 1992 at Forbes magazine. We had a cover story called Why Do We Feel So Bad When Things Are Good? And it turned out to be a great time to get into the market. People felt absolutely horrible when the market finally bottomed in 2002 in the fall, and that was precisely the time to be in the market because the underlying dynamics were good. But all of us who are followers of George Gilder are optimists. George is my mentor, as many of you know, the person who got me into magazines. And I was first attracted to George. George's writing in the late 70s and early 80s because I saw this voice of optimism, and it wasn't a kind of Pollyannish optimism. It was an optimism based on what people could really do if they were liberated from the shackles of high taxation and regulation. And George, I think we're going to make this case that it's a great time to be alive. It's a great time to be in the market. The technologies that are coming to the fore right now give us all the reason in the world to be optimistic about the future. And I would like to, without further ado, bring up the king of optimism, George Gilder.
Thank you, Rich, and welcome again to Telecosm. Now, this Telecosm is taking a somewhat different path than previous Telecosms. The Telecosm has always been regarded to be a gigantic thing. It's tele, it's long distances, it's transmitting information at the speed of light around the globe. However, my daughter now is writing a book about quantum theory, which is called a phenomenon called entanglement, which shows that quantum elements, you know, the smallest things by conventional analysis, actually reach out across the universe, and are the quantum effects are not limited in microcosmic effects necessarily. They also stretch out across the universe. And Carver Mead has been making that same point over and over again as he explores the cryogenics of superconductivity. He discovers electrons that are macroscopic electrons and photons that are 12 feet high. And these are the microscopic and the macroscopic are converging in this telecosm. So we are no longer, so when we reach out out nanotech and biotech, it seems as if this is a break from the ordinary telecommunications concern. But as Moore's law approaches its asymptotes, its points of diminishing return, we find that we are necessarily exploring the very small as it reaches into the very large and enables such new products as the telepewter that we have been celebrating and calling for since the very first telecosm. Could I have some water? So, and from the beginning, the telecosm has been founded on the microcosm, and it's sprung from it. Obviously, none of the telecommunications capabilities that we have would be feasible without the foundation of semiconductor electronics. And semiconductor electronics for decades has really operated at the nanotech level, as we call it today. The gate oxides in semiconductors are 2 or 3 nanometers deep, and these are the really critical smallest elements in every transistor. And Carver, decades ago, was exploring tunnel oxides that were two or three nanometers deep. And this really has been the foundation of everything we've done has always been, in a sense, nanotech. And on the other side, a second foundation has been information theory. This is Shannon's analysis of the capability of a carrier, how much information can be sent down a particular channel in the presence of noise. And from this analysis, which he did at MIT and Bell Labs, has sprung much of the telecommunication networks that we have. And information theory, again, converges the nanocosm with the telecosm, and with biotech as well, because all of biotech is really based on information theory. The cell is an information processor. That's the great discovery of recent times. And so the microcosm of semiconductors converges very compatibly with the microcosm of biotechnology, and devices like microarrays that inscribe millions of DNA, single-strand DNA, on the surface of a silicon device to detect pathogens or identify genetic material are all microcosmic devices that are deeply founded in information theory. So this is a time of convergence, and the new technologies that are emerging today are mostly spring from these convergences, from biotech and nanotech, information theory, semiconductors, quantum physics, entanglement across the universe. All these technologies are becoming increasingly one, and that is the real singularity that we are celebrating today at this ninth telecosm conference. So I want to welcome Josh Wolf here to introduce this conference to the thrilling opportunities and the profound science that is being explored in the nanotech realm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George and Rich and Fort. We've got a lot to cover today. I'm going to give the caveat that I speak very, very slowly. And for those of you who have actually heard me speak before, you know that my clock speed is probably off the charts. So you're going to get an enormous amount of information density in a very short amount of time. We're going to cover pants. We're going to cover tools. We're going to cover Dustin Hoffman and Academy Award-winning movies. I'm going to tell you a story of a car trip that George and I and a cardiologist took that I think you'll find entertaining. Just a quick background on why I got into this field. This was I write the Forbes Wolf Nanotech Report. I'm a partner at a venture capital firm that invests in advanced materials and, as it's often more sexually referred to, as nanotechnology. We decided, if you look at kind of this cascading series of S-curves that you saw Ray Kurzweil show last night, we went from the PC opportunity in the 70s to biotech in the 80s to internet and telecom and communications revolutions throughout the 90s. And our contention was that there was an area within the academic disciplines that was heavily neglected, which was the realm of material science as it interacted with biology and electrical engineering and physics. And this was an area that was virgin territory that was ripe for venture investing, so that's kind of why we situated ourselves accordingly. I'm going to talk also a little bit about some of our portfolio companies so that you can understand why we're investing where we are. These are the companies today that are in the private market that you cannot yet invest in. And they will be accessing the public markets over the next year or two. Some of these companies will be the next IPO. Some of them will have Netscape-like phenomenon, or at least I predict so. And we'll talk about what their business models are, because in some of these cases, these are models that you've never seen before, hybrids between a biotech pipeline and a fabulous semiconductor IP, all in one company, and we'll talk about that. Karyos is actually a deal that was announced this week, which is a very notable one. We did this with Genentech and Philips Medical, and this is targeted therapy at the molecular scale for cancer, at the earliest stages of disease detection. And the other companies, you'll see that nanotech itself is this very, very discipline. I mean, it ranges from everything from capital equipment, in the case of this company, Molecular Imprints, based out of Texas, to NanoSys, which is a company that owns about 500 patents in the field of inorganic semiconductors, licensed in from Cornell and MIT and Caltech and Harvard and Hebrew University in Israel. And Cambrios uses biology to manufacture electronics. So the same way that we make beer and cheese and wine today using fermentation processes with yeast, you will see, as I describe later on, how we are actually creating, much in Ray's vision of last night, three-dimensional electronics using biology. And the reason that that's important, not just because it's a sexy-sounding technology, but because it dramatically changes the economics of how you manufacture something. This is a little bit of history, and I apologize throughout some of these slides. Some of this is going to be in nano-sized font, very, very small, and I will clarify things that are a little difficult to see. The brainchild of this really starts, or at least is credited to Richard Feynman, who is a notorious Nobel Prize winner, prankster in the physics world, and he started the speech of Caltech in 1959, saying that the principles of physics, as far as I can see, don't speak against the possibility of us actually manipulating things atom by atom. Just say we don't have the tools. Well, over the next 20 or 30 years, those tools would be invented. They'd actually be invented by IBM. IBM would sell off their rights to manufacture those tools to a company called Zico, which today is a publicly traded company, generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, selling these tools, and I'll talk about them as one of the early beneficiaries of this field. So you've got about 20 or 30 years of progress in the physical sciences out of Harvard and Berkeley and Caltech particularly. And then right around the end of the 20th century, you have the president, President Clinton, turn to his science advisor and say, what's the biggest area that we should be involved in as a nation? And he definitively responded, nanotechnology. Well, that set off a field of dreams, a metaphorical poker game, where all of these nations around the world started to ante up more and more dollars to become the leading center of excellence for researchers, for company formation, and so on throughout the world in nanotechnology. President Clinton started off with a $200 million initiative, just investing in basic research, basic science. And as you'll see as I go through, that has now approached $1 billion a year in spending. It is new capital that is allocated towards the field, and it is a big driver towards both some of the companies, which are investable ideas, and many of the scientists, which are seeing their work increase at an exponential rate. This is just a series of cartoons. I am a little bit smaller than the average size man, billions of nanometers. We're all about 2 billion nanometers on average. A single nanometer is, if you were to pluck one of your hairs from your head, about 100,000 times smaller than that single hair. So we are talking about individual size of atoms and molecules. So maybe between 2 and 4 atoms would equal about 1 nanometer. In the case of hydrogen, which you see in the third cartoon, which is about 9 orders of magnitude smaller, those little blue dots are representative of individual hydrogen atoms lined up into a horizontal row for 1 nanometer. Now, that is the scale today that people are developing technology on and rationally designing material with properties that never existed before. This is a chart that Forbes made to show the difference between things that occur naturally, things that are synthetically man-made. The notable thing here, if you look at the bottom right, there's an item that looks kind of like a rolled-up piece of chicken wire. It's known as a carbon nanotube. And carbon nanotube and its close cousin, the fullerene, you'll see why it's called a fullerene in a little bit, won a Nobel Prize in 1996. Well, they didn't actually win the Nobel Prize, but the scientists who discovered them did. And they are the same size as DNA. DNA is about 2 nanometers wide. And that's everything that the past 10 years of genomics and the Human Genome Project and so forth was predicated upon. And now we've got a material that only a little over a decade ago, a little under a decade, was discovered that has properties that are 100 times stronger than steel, 1/6 of its weight, better thermal conductivity than diamond, better electrical conductivity than copper. And this is something that we never knew existed. Now, if you think about it, it's just carbon. The carbon in your diamond ring and the carbon that is in your graphite pencil that you write with are the same atomic composition, just a different configuration of their lattice. And if you can think about how you can manipulate individual atoms in such a way, under the laws of physics, you can engineer materials precisely how you want them, get new applications, open up new markets, bigger margins, more profits, and so forth. Some people will say that there's this continuous scaling down of nanotech, and that we've been doing this for, 40, 50 years. Part of my contention is that this isn't the case. I don't count MEMS and microsystems and some of these other things as nanotech. I'm a little bit more of a purist. And, we've got our ENIAC machine and scaled down to a laptop. We've got a laptop bench of optics that are scaled down to MEMS devices, microelectromechanical systems. You've got a chemistry or biological workbench that's being scaled down to the microfluidic chips of publicly traded companies like Caliper and Affymetrix and others. And our contention is that this isn't the case, that it's not just a scaling down, but that it is more of a bottoms-up approach, what E.O. Wilson might have called the consilience of all of these different fields. And if you look at the fields that are interacting, there is a scientific renaissance between the hard sciences, material science on the top left, the life sciences, the green circle, the computer sciences and electrical engineering that the past 10 years or 15 years of computer revolution has been predicated on. And at that central point between all of these disparate disciplines, really seemingly disparate disciplines, is this emergence, just what George was saying, this convergence of all of these fields. Well, if you go to Hewlett-Packard's lab in California and you talk to Stan Williams, who's the head of their nanotech research unit, he'll describe something like this. Shout it out if you know what this image is. Tower of Babel is absolutely right. Now, I'm not a religious person, but if you invoke this analogy, you've got this, story of lots of people speaking different languages, building towards a common goal up towards the sky. If you invert this in a Charlie Munger sense, you've got now a perfect analogy for nanotechnology. You have lots of people speaking different languages, but not English or Spanish or German, but material science and electrical engineering and biology. And in fact, if you go to any university campus, what you will see is that new buildings are being put into the engineering quad to interface these different disciplines. My alma mater, Cornell University up in Ithaca, New York, has built a $60 million facility which does just that. And a lot of these guys never spoke to each other. So you start to develop the scientific creole between these disciplines as people are talking to one another. So how do we define nanotech? Well, our definition in our purest sense is that it is the purposeful engineering of matter at scales below 100 nanometers. The reason that we like that level of 100 nanometers is that interesting things start to happen below that scale. And if you can rationally control things like band gap effects, and you can tune materials. And the point is to achieve size-dependent properties and functions. So we don't count nano by accident, things that, you might see nanoparticles in pigments or in stained glass or in ancient Egyptian pottery, maybe even in cat litter. You don't see scales of less than 100 nanometers. It's really small, but it's not just about being small, it's about being different. It's that at a certain size, you can take the same fundamental molecule and just change its size. the growth of a crystal and get totally different properties. So you'll see later that rather than thinking about the previous choices in a binary switch sense, do we use silicon or germanium or gallium arsenide, that you can tune material so that you can get the behavior of full solid slab of silicon using silicon nanowires. These are some of the products that are being developed today. You've got carbon nanotube crossbar memory. Well, remember those rolls of chicken wire that I talked about? Well, you can actually take advantage of the van der Waals properties, property in physics, the weak atomic force between these that can regulate the zeros and ones, the bits that flow through them. Now, I'm of the persuasion that any mechanical thing is always going to be inferior to a purely electrical phenomenon, so I don't think that this is going to be a solution that will work over time. The company in this case is Nantero out of Woldboro, Massachusetts, and they've already got partnerships with LSI Logic and BAE Systems. Semiconductor nanocrystal biolabels, I believe that the lights are low enough for this, but the property that I just described in the last slide, being able to tune a material just by changing its size. I'm holding up a leucite. Inside the leucite is five different little vials that hold cadmium selenide. They are nano-sized crystals that are engineered with precision. We can get the same crystals of the exact same size every single time. And this is by one of our portfolio companies, NanoSys. And if I apply a source of UV light to these crystals, you will see an entire spectrum of color. Well, that's kind of interesting, but what's going on? From 1 nanometer to 2 nanometer to 3 to 4 to 5, just change the size of the particle using the exact same processing, and you get totally different functions. In this case, optical and electronic. So again, the idea of tuning a material that is fundamentally identical. And just so you understand, if I take my coffee mug and I shrink this down, it's just a miniature coffee mug. It's still white, still ceramic, still has the same kind of shape and size and function. But at that scale, with certain materials, you can tune them. One of the other interesting examples on the bottom, the artificial setae, this is something that the U.S. Army is working on, also with one of our portfolio companies. People used to think that the gecko lizard was something that secreted from its paws, and that's how it stuck to walls like Spider-Man can climb and hang upside down. And it turns out that it doesn't do any such thing. In fact, it actually has millions of these little hairs called setae. And each setae, similarly to that previous technology, has van der Waals forces. Each one very atomically weak, but massively parallel array, you get a very strong force. So strong that if you were to try to pull one of these gecko lizards off a wall, you would sever its limb from its body. And so one of our portfolio companies has now reverse-engineered that process and grown silicon nanowires onto a surface at a density of 1,000 times greater, so a billion of these little wires. And somebody about my size, weighing about 160 pounds, with a piece of paper this thin on both their hands and their feet can scale a wall like Spider-Man. Well, the interesting application of that is obviously intuitive for the defense, special ops forces that can quietly scale walls. But the less intuitive one is for medical, for surgery, for healthcare. If you want to prevent thrombosis or clamping of arteries when you're doing cardiothoracic surgery, you can use this as a universal Velcro to just touch a vein. And I'll actually show you a video in a little bit of what that looks like. How much money is going into the field? Well, about $9 billion just last year. The majority of that has been from the government because the government has been fueling this process. They've been the catalyst, setting up the driving force. Corporations are now taking the baton. And right now, it's about matched one-to-one, meaning that the U.S. government and U.S. corporations are spending about equal amounts. We predict that U.S. corporations are now taking off, and the government amount will stay steady, about $1 billion a year invested in the field. There's three drivers that you should know about so you can understand how to play this space or invest in it. The first is the funding. So you've got exponential growth, which I just described. I'll go a little bit more in detail in the next slide on this. $9 billion just last year. Around the world. This is twice the size of the Human Genome Project, which, of course, graced all the covers of our major trade publications, and a lot of investment dollars went into. The corporate players are counting this as a top priority. Jeff Immelt of GE specifically said that nanotech and nanomaterials is one of their top three priorities. Why? Well, nanotech affects everything in GE's business, from their jet turbine business to solid-state lighting, replacing light bulbs and filaments, to medical imaging and MRI machines to get very discrete single-molecule detection of diseases or of organs. So I think there was a conference about a year ago, and two separate events, both Jeff Bezos and Michael Dell, were asked, if you could do anything today, if you were starting Dell over today, what area would you focus on? And sure enough, Dell said nanotechnology, and Jeff Bezos said the same thing. Technology itself is increasing exponentially. This is the chart that shows the number of publications and the number of patents that are being awarded in the sector. And you can see, again, this kind of knee of the curve starting around 95, 96, and then taking off in a very vertical sense. Earlier in the fall of this past year, we have a public policy group which helps to influence the legislative bodies that govern the field and helps put money in pro nanotech legislature. And the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office created a new category for nanotechnology. So when that happened in biotech some 20 years ago, there was an exponential increase in the number of companies that were formed, the number of patents that were awarded, the amount of venture creation that was started. The media itself is increasing exponentially, and this is just a qualitative measure. It's a measure of some of the hyperbole that's in the space, because there's a lot of it. It's a measure of the students that write letters and say, hey, where do I go to take nanotech courses? Where do I go to investors saying, how do I learn about this space? And you get this critical momentum in the per-box sense that ultimately there will be some critical moment, a Netscape-like event, and we predict that may occur over the next 12 months in the capital markets. So this was the act that we had Senator Hillary Clinton, Senator Ron Wyden sponsor, and it was a billion-dollar-a-year initiative called the 21st Century Nanotech R&D Act. And this was the White House a little over a year ago, and there was about 8 of us that joined the president, and this is a $4 billion government stimulus. Now, how do you pay back the president when he's giving you $1 billion a year in government money? We gave him a $7 commemorative plastic thing. This was made by Cornell University, my alma mater. It was a nanoscale White House and an American flag that lit up with quantum dots, and I can assure you he had absolutely no idea what I was handing him. The international government spending trends right now, the U.S., again, in the field of dreams mentality, has prompted all these other countries to ante up. So it's not just the U.S., but you've got Japan and Germany and Singapore and China, where I was just about a week and a half ago. And the pace and the momentum and the excitement there is really, really high. So what's a useful metric to track? Right now, one out of every $4 from our tax dollars accounts for R&D spending in the world. So the U.S. is spending about 25% of the global accounts that's being spent on nanotechnology. And about one out of every two papers are coming from U.S. scientists. So today, that is a good metric to say that the U.S. is leveraging its dollars pretty well, but I anticipate that over the next few years, that denominator will come down pretty significantly, and you will see foreign entities start to be more competitive. So if you go through kind of in a very quick sense here, you've got bipartisan political support, both sides of the aisle supporting this as the next industrial revolution for the United States, in some sense a way to bring manufacturing back, and I'll describe that later. Stimulates government spending. The government spending, in turn, goes to the research centers, and the first thing that the research centers do is buy tools, buy equipment. Now, this is no genius idea. This is just saying, look at the historic precedent. Look at the railroads. Look at the internet. Look at electricity. In the early 90s, you wanted to own the Sun routers and the Cisco servers that were the infrastructure behind whatever the dot-com and the venture-funded startups were ultimately developed. Today in nanotech, those companies are companies like Veeco or FEI Company or Molecular Imprint that are manufacturing the tools that are being demanded today to do things at this scale. So the companies that are selling the tools benefit. They all have kind of interesting acronyms like STM and AFM. STM stands for Scanning Tunneling Microscope. AFM stands for Atomic Force Microscope. Now, what this machine actually does is it turns out that these materials, atoms and molecules, are actually way below the wavelength of the light. So you can't actually see things, no matter how hard you try. You kind of have to touch them. An atomic force microscope goes over basic topography of a material and can tell you with a laser and an actuator that goes back and says this is what you're looking at. Molecular Imprint is able to make features that are between 10 and 50 nanometers. This is a company that was founded a little over 2 years ago that we're an investor in. They're now doing about $20 million a year in revenue selling these tools to Motorola, to Hewlett-Packard, and all the research centers around the world. The availability of tools, in turn, drives the exponential faster and higher with scientific discovery. So the scientists now have these tools. They're able to accelerate their pace of discovery. And that, in turn, turns into patents. If you look at the patent landscape, over the past 20 years, again, an exponential increase in the number of U.S. nanotech patents and applications. This is a chart that shows just a handful of the materials, like fullerenes and carbon nanotubes and dendrimers and quantum dots and nanowires, and the voracious rate at which people are trying to file for claims on these materials, the composition of matter, how you make these molecules, their integration into a device, their end uses, their end applications. So both startup companies and multinational major large companies are very aggressively viewing this as a land grab mentality in intellectual property. We've also kind of mapped out the white space. This is a very difficult chart to read, but if you look at the dark dots, that's where you don't want to be as an investor. because you're going to be subject to all kinds of litigation in the future. There's all kinds of cross-claims and high entanglement. The white space is areas where we think there's pockets of opportunity as venture investors to lock up some of the key foundational patents and exploit those over time. So those scientific discoveries get a lot of attention, and that lot of attention drives a lot of things. If you look at just a chart here showing Red Herring and Forbes and Tech Review and Business Week, all doing cover stories of nanotechnology, this is the number of mentions of the word nanotechnology or nanotech over the past few years. Well, the reason that this chart's important is if you did the same chart for the Internet, what you saw in 1994 and 1995 was an exponential increase in the usage of the word Internet, which coincided right around 94 with this huge explosion, about 9 times the previous year, and that in turn set the stage for public market receptivity, excitement amongst retail investors, and what would set the stage for the Netscape IPO and the subsequent boom and bust in the Internet. So we think that that year is upon us with nanotech. We think it's going to happen over the next 2 years. I think we're still in the same generation, and people are once bitten, twice shy. You're not going to see the same dramatic impact of a Netscape-type IPO, but there will be fits and starts of human psychology and sentiment within this field. People overestimating things in the short term, underestimating them in the long term. One of the comments here, and I'll share the anecdote that I promised about George and I and a cardiologist in a road trip. We were driving to a conference, and a cardiologist was driving, and driving kind of slow, pulled up at a light. All of a sudden, carjacker comes and bangs on the window, and very scarily pulls the cardiologist out of the car. And all of us, we were lined up, and the cardiologist he pointed a gun at and said, "I'm going to shoot each one of you unless you tell me why I should let you live." And the cardiologist said, "Well, I'm a cardiologist. I save people's lives. I'm mothers and children and husbands and brothers and sisters." And the carjacker just popped his head back and laughed and shot the cardiologist and killed him. And then he turned to me and he said, "You and nanotechnology, tell me why I should let you live." Before I could even speak, George jumps in front and says, "Please shoot me now before I have to hear how nanotech is going to save the world and end world peace." The truth is, there are analogies over the past 10, 20 years that you can look to for this field. This isn't, you know, anything, you shouldn't buy the hype about the new thing. This is technology in its most Schumpeterian, it's always creative disruption. This is the latest form. It just happens to be in manufacturing and material science. Like biotech, we think that it's going to have fits and starts. Most of the stocks today are driven by retail investors. It's very laughable to look at the message boards and see what people are writing. When we went into the White House, they took away our BlackBerries and our pagers, and Secret Service gives it to us when we got out 2 hours later. And I looked at Nanogen. I got a stock alert for this company, which has nothing to do with nanotechnology. It was up 55% on the day because they had nano in their name, and people presumed that there was some correlation to what the president was doing in the Oval Office. And I think you're going to see a lot of that, where, you know, we've gone on and said that a nano rose by any other name is still a rose. The first thing you should do when you see these companies from an investment perspective is throw out whatever they're calling themselves and ask, what are they doing? Are they just repositioning themselves? Are they just trying to capture some buzz or cachet? There was a company, I think it was called Nano Signal, and we wrote this up in our Forbes report to say, beware of these nano pretenders. And these guys had changed their name more times than Prince. They went from microsignal to nanosignal to, they were like a car wash company. And so, you know, I went on TV and said, you know, these guys are about as closely related to nanotechnology as Andrew Jackson is to Michael Jackson. They've got absolutely nothing in common. So if you look at Harris & Harris Group, which is one of the companies that we follow, this is a publicly traded incubator. They're kind of like CMGI was for the Internet, Harris & Harris is for nanotech. And it's run by a guy, Charlie Harris, a good friend of mine, and they run a clean organization. They invest. It's one of the ways that you can own private stakes in companies by investing in a public company. And I'm not advocating that you buy the company. I think it's a very volatile stock, as I'll show you here. President signs the bill, and you see what happens to their stock. It goes through the roof through January. CNBC starts profiling nanotech pretty heavily, and you've got Jim Cramer, you know, going, "Nano's the, you know, the..." And one of our companies, we said, well, you know, just as all humans do, that we're going to presume linearity, and, you know, this is going to continue forever. So we decided to file an S-1 for Nanosys to take it public August of last year. And then as soon as we filed that, the market started to tank, and we ultimately pulled the IPO due to market conditions. And we expected that company will be out sometime in the next year. So the perception in the capital market side of things is that nanotech is 10 years off. Right? I mean, this is not an investable area today. The reality is that it is. And here's a few ideas from FEI Company, which makes the tools, to Accelerus, which makes software, to American Pharmaceutical Partners, which does cancer treatments. Yeah, if you look at just FEI as an example, net income was up 81% over the first quarter of last year, and nanotech research demand, the tools that they're selling to the institutes and the universities and the government laboratories and the venture-funded startups are increasing at double-digit rates. And that's the trend that we accurately predicted and we think will continue for the next few years. Today, there's a disconnect between the fundamentals and the stock price, and we expect that that will change as you get more sophisticated, larger institutional investors coming into the space. The companies that are gaining the most today are not the ones that are seeing their prices go through the roof. It's the companies that are using the technologies that those companies are actually incorporating. And I'll show you a value chain in a few moments. Lux Research, which is one of the companies that we own, is actually launching an index, an ETF. I believe it's with PowerShares, and that will launch in October next month, which we're pretty excited about. This was a quote from CNBC. This was an anonymous company. It's actually Lucent. And they say that life usually deals with a combination of fear and greed. In this case, the fear is that nanotech is going to kill current cash cows, and the greed is that we can use nanotech to kill someone else's cash cow. And this is kind of the yin and yang, greed and fear of the market, both from a scientific perspective and from a market perspective. So how do you disrupt these cash cow businesses? You know, and again, it's a little small for you to see, but everything from chemicals to semiconductors to pharma and biotech to energy to aerospace and defense are all starting to voraciously spend in R&D by investing in startup companies, investing in venture funds, doing their own internal work to find some of these advances. Some of the ways that conventional wisdom in the space is wrong, and then I'll dive into these corporations. Conventional wisdom says that there's a nanotech market today that's comprised of nanotech companies that make nanotech products. And we argue that that's not the case. Today, it's just a value chain. Just like biotech in the early days. Biotech is not an industry in the first 5 to 6 years of its creation. Over time, it will become an industry, but today it is a general-purpose technology in a classical sense. It is an enabling technology, a horizontal technology, much like electricity or the Internet was. All nanotech products are not new. There's emerging nanotechnology, but there's also this backdrop of established things that people are trying to reclassify and say that it's nanotech because there's a lot of excitement and euphoria. The other misconception is that anything with nano has the potential for huge profit margins, and that's also false. We think that many products that are incorporating nanotech will be only marginally profitable. And I hope to show you some of those in these coming slides. This is what the value chain looks like. If you go from nanomaterials, which are the raw inputs, into nano intermediates, so that's a product that might have some nanoscale feature in it that can enhance it, improve its margins, and so forth, and then you get a finished product. Across that spectrum, throughout the whole range of that, you have these nano tools. These are some of the companies that are the nanotech specialists, people that are just pure play nanotech companies. You have the end-use incumbents in green here that are licensing or partnering with these companies. You have the tool providers and the nano-intermediates I've omitted there. If you look here at who they are, what they do, the typical value chain stage, the notable thing is that the nanotech specialists are almost entirely private. Maybe there's a few public companies. The end-use incumbents are almost entirely public with only a few private ones. Just by nature, they've got the leverage in buying and supplying. And the tool providers, there's an even mix of both public and private companies. Let me show you what one of these tools does. And I want you to see if you can, this is an excavation. It is the equivalent of taking a spoon of dirt out of the Grand Canyon. And I want you to see if you can guess, as I go through this, what the object is that's being pulled out and what it's being pulled out of. As you get to the edge of this, you'll start to see that it's the inside of the number 9 on a dime. That's how small we're talking of the scale of the ability to pull out a piece of material of defined geometry. Well, the trends over the past year or two, you've got government spending that's the largest since the space race. You've got large cap companies that are signing deals and launching products. I'll show you who they are. You've got technology that's starting to migrate into high volume products. VC investment is on the rise. IPO is expected sometime end of this year, early next. On the business, government, and technical side, I'll skip the top two because we've covered that a bit, but Infineon produced the world's smallest transistor earlier this year based on carbon nanotubes. Wade talked a little bit about that last night. FEI company broke the 1 angstrom resolution imaging barrier. Motorola unveiled a nano-emissive display, which I'll also talk about in a bit and what they're doing. These are some of the companies that are spending at least 5% of their R&D on this field, as we very narrowly define it. And you can see the broad range of folks from Praxair, Daimler Chrysler, to sporting good companies, to food and beverage businesses, and you can understand why this is very horizontal, broad, enabling technology. The number of people that are working on nanotechnology is increasing. Right now it's about 5% of budgets, and that's increasing to 10-12% over the next 2-3 years. The number of products that are incorporating nanotechnology today is small and increasing also fairly exponentially. We can look at some of the threats to all of these various companies, from Procter & Gamble to Henkel to Nike to Motorola. You've got deals that are being struck now by all sorts of companies. I'll focus on two of our portfolio companies as we go through this, and the deals that they struck, their business model, and why we put money behind them. If you look at both the breadth and the depth of impact, there are some applications that you need to be aware of that you don't want to be investing in because they're low margin, they're just augmentation of existing products. And there are other ones that have a very deep impact with a very narrow focus that we think are the venture-backable types of businesses. If you look at some of the products that are on the market now, the easiest one to understand, I've got a lot of little bag of tricks here, is a pair of khaki pants and ties and shirts that you can buy at Eddie Bauer and Brooks Brothers and The Gap and Old Navy. And I actually don't have a bottle of water here. George, can I borrow a glass of water? The business model behind this company is much akin to Coca-Cola. It's essentially a secret formula, a polymer mix, that goes into a fabric of choice, whether it's rayon or silk, whatever material you want. One end of that will bind to the fabric, and the other end will bind and prevent, in a hydrophobic way, the water, anything aqueous, from sticking to it. So you can pour wine or coffee or soda or water on your pants or on your tie, and it will just beat up and drip right off. And this is probably a bit hard to see, but I will leave it around for demonstration, that you can pour water onto your pants, and it just drips right off. Well, this is interesting, and from a venture-backable perspective, it's kind of unique, and the company is doing now about $25 million in revenue, and it's got nice margins, and it's about 2 years old. The more interesting thing is the derivative impact that that kind of technology has on blue-chip companies, like Procter & Gamble and Henkel. Because you can imagine from wearing those pants, if you have to wash them maybe 25 or 30% less. And if you're washing them 25 or 30% less, conceivably, you're using an equivalent amount less of detergent, spray and wash, stain stick. And so Procter & Gamble over time starts to see a hit. And in fact, they were down 11% this past quarter in profitability. I don't think it's yet attributed to these pants. But I think over time you will see that kind of impact. Now, there's a second-order derivative effect, which is the chemical suppliers that make the chemicals which go into the detergents and the spray and wash and the stain stick. And so if you can understand that value chain and you have a window into these types of technology, you can make predictive bets accordingly. If you look at the margins on this, the pants that I've got here are from Old Navy. And they have a brand on it just like Gore-Tex, which is Nanotex. This particular product is called NanoCare. Tiger Woods has a deal with Nike. He explicitly wants this material in all of his lines of clothing. Those pair of pants normally cost about $19, and they sell for $29 at Old Navy with this nanotech enhancement. A little bit smaller margin appreciation from Eddie Bauer, where it's $5 premium, and you can break down who captures most of that value, if it's a retail company, if it's a branded apparel company, if it's nanotech and so forth, and understand who in that value chain has the biggest margins and how it's going to erode over time, and that's useful for us when we make our investments. Another hard-to-read chart, that's just basically showing the expectation of the deployment of all these various applications over time and by sector. And you can see that we break it down kind of on a triplet of manufacturing materials, healthcare and life sciences, and electronics and IT. If you look at the automobile, Europe just announced last week, I think they call it NanoMobile. It's Daimler Chrysler and VW Group and a whole slew of others that are engaged now to work together to bring some of these nano advancements so that they can jointly uniformly share them. Everything from catalysts using fuel, to coatings that can be used on the sides of the sidings or the tires to make cars that are lighter, more fuel efficient, tougher, more resistant to wear and tear, and so on. You look at some of the applications relevant to a mobile phone, everything from multi-purpose memory to nano-pattern logic chips to cooling systems. Now, a lot of people are saying, let's put solar cells into some of these phones. Motorola is one of our investors in our fund. And they're interested not in something like this where you've got a silly piece of solar fiber that you plug into your phone. I mean, just behaviorally, nobody will ever do that. But you can imagine if you have your BlackBerry, you know, the blue pigment on your BlackBerry is just a non-functional pigment, right? It's just a color. It gives off an optical effect. But if you can functionalize these molecules in a way so that you are getting some energy, some trickle charge from whether it's ambient light or solar energy or heat, thermal radiation from your body, kinetic energy as you move, then you've got some kind of interesting device. And you can look at the impact that those kinds of things will have across the value chain of the OEMs, the technology licensors, the consumers, even being more creative thinking about the electrical utilities. And if you're using more and more solar energy and relying less and less on charging your devices on the grid, the kind of ripple effect that those things will have and how large the magnitude of those effects will be. Now that's kind of the fun part. I'm going to give you some analogies for how you think about this field. And I'm going to ask you by a show of hands, how many people have seen the Dustin Hoffman movie, The Graduate? How many people remember this scene? Now, I have a feeling you guys saw a different edited version than I did.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Nanotechnology.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in nanotechnology. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Enough said. That's the deal.
And again, I have a feeling you guys might have seen a different version of it. The reason that plastics were so interesting, 20, 30 years ago, when you had the ability, for the first time really with polymer control, you had the ability to put structural control over matter, okay, in a sense that you can affect food and beverage bottling, the plastic bottles that we drink our water from, communication wires, compact discs for storage of information. So the structural control using polymer technology, that ultimately had a $1 trillion-plus impact on all sectors of the economy, very broadly. Today, with nanostructure materials, not only do you get the structure, but you can embed the function as well. So you can tune things optically, electronically, magnetically, thermally to get desired effects that you want. So you can think about a company that makes packaged salad or some other kind of food packaging with a normal plastic bag that can now optically light up and tell you and indicate that the food's gone bad or the salmonella poison. One of the analogies that I think is the most important to think about in this space, and again, drawing from my first point, that this isn't just about getting smaller and smaller. It's about changing the economics of manufacturing. 20 years ago, if you were in the pharma business, this analogy will be between biotech and nanotech, and I think it's a salient one. If you were in the pharma business and making insulin for diabetic patients, the way that you would do that was to have a large amount of cash on your balance sheet. You'd have lots of fixed assets, lots of investment in sheep and pigs and whatever organisms you keep on this farm. You'd kill those animals, grind up their intestines, extract protein from their blood, solubilize it, put it into a human form factor, and sell it as a drug. And that was a profit, maybe 100 steps, tens of millions of dollars, and a very linear kind of process. Along come two scientists, and those two scientists figure out a way to take a gene vector, recombinant DNA, and put it into a bacteria and mass-produce insulin, essentially at room temperature. And that totally changed the economics of manufacture and shifted the factors of success from one that was based on the scale of your operation on this left side to one that now became based on the creativity of the scientists and the design, the recipe that they owned and controlled and had patents for. And that was an environment that was ripe for venture capital firms to come in, put in the right incentive structures, and build value in those kinds of companies. What I just described in that transition became Genentech and Amgen. Today, the same thing is happening. This is a rough inside of a Class 100 clean room, likes of Intel and TI. And we can do more sophisticated things in our portfolio companies like Nanosys, which Intel is a publicly disclosed investor in, than these guys can do in some of the most state-of-the-art sophisticated fabrication facilities today that cost $1 billion plus to manufacture by actually assembling or growing these chemically. And what you see there, which is difficult, kind of a zebra-striped wire, is a heterojunction wire alternating bands of silicon, germanium, gallium arsenide, which you normally would need multiple different processes and capital equipment to do, which Nanosys is able to do through growth processes. So you have this kind of history throughout time in the world of shifting from iron to plastic to nanotech in a material sense, and the processing side from the Industrial Revolution to business process reengineering, and again, to nanotech today. If I give you a few examples here so that you understand the science, why this is interesting, the surface area to volume effect. If you take this glass of water and you take a rock candy, you know, on a stick that you might put into your coffee, it might take an hour to dissolve. if you take a smaller grain of sugar, like table sugar, it would dissolve in maybe 5 minutes. And if you took confectionery sugars that you bake a cake with, it would dissolve fairly instantaneously. The correlation being the smaller the particle size, the more reactive it is, the greater the surface area. And that's useful not only for pharmaceutical companies who have some $80 billion worth of drugs coming off patent, that they're trying to reformulate these drugs, extend the patent life cycles, increase the bioavailability in the body, but also do interesting things with surfaces that I can also show you when I'm done with the presentation. The size-dependent properties, something like quantum dot, the fact that you can use the same process to make devices that are exactly the same composition, just a different size. A word that I've come up with that's a little bit of a corny word, I've called it simplexity. And the idea is to take complexity out of a manufacturing process or some man-made engineered device and simplify it by putting that complexity of whatever that end thing does into the material itself. So in this case, you can see a solar cell made by one of our portfolio companies, which has the geometry, the molecular scale of a tetrapod, and it's manufactured in that way in solution so that it can essentially be poured onto a surface and hooked up to a backplane of electronics and have a flexible working solar cell. And that's a deal that we've struck with one of our companies, with Matsushita, the parent company for Panasonic, which happens to be the largest architectural producer of glass in Asia. And I think you'll see that rolled out in the first quarter of 2006. The other thing that you get is a transition from semiconductors in a traditional Gen 7 state-of-the-art facility over the next decade to something that looks more like roll-to-roll processing, where you are printing electronics in much in the same way, again, that you print pigment today for newspapers and magazines, but instead of printing an optical dye, you're printing something that is functional and can be patterned, rationally designed. I'm going to skip over this analogy and go back to the capital markets. So the key thing here, not just about size, not just about miniaturization, the idea that new properties that you can tune open up new markets, you can harvest value as investors and partners in these companies by owning the IP, focusing on application-focused technologies, changing the economics of manufacturing, supply chains. The way that we invest in this is thinking about three things: recipes, toll booths, and moats. Now, recipes are that idea of shifting the factors of success away from the fixed assets and the capital equipment to the guys that can do things with these underlying patents. The toll booths are the idea that you can take the patents that you own and license off the non-core ones to your business, generate cash flow early on in the business, and the moats are the traditional Munger Buffett sense of the word, that you can build a competitive advantage around your company using that intellectual property. About 1,200 companies have been funded in the space. 90% or more of these companies will definitively fail. That is a rule of technology and innovation. Our job as investors and as writers and authors and so forth is to find that 10% that is going to go on, change the world, and survive. The amount of venture money, at least over the past 3 years, has declined, and I think that's not necessarily symbolic of anything. I just think that you're going to see fits and starts in the funding, and I think you're going to see a power law, similar to what Chris described yesterday, of the number of companies that receive an amount of funding. I think you'll see 4 or 5 companies a year account for 80% of the venture funding that go into a space, and typically those rounds are spaced out by 3 or 4 years. The valuations of companies have come down. This is across the board, not just nanotech, and that has a correlation to the public markets. In fact, a direct inverse correlation. When the NASDAQ is rocking, then the amount of time it takes you to take one of these private companies public is very short. When the NASDAQ is not doing so well, that time extends. And you can look at the geographic strength of nanotech across the country. It is, of course, in California. It is in Route 128. But it is not isolated to those areas. It's happening in Texas, in upstate New York, of all places. And I think this is something that's probably concordant with Rich's book about finding these college towns and places where innovation now in these areas of nanotechnology is also spurring growth and value in these smaller communities. If you look at some of the research groups, the source of talent, you'll see that just in the past 2 years, from one research group, you've seen a huge amount of spin-off of some of the graduate students. And it's hard to track where all these people are going and all the opportunities for investing. If you turn to history as a guide, there's really two phases in how this will all develop. The first is going from infrastructure to application. So that's the tool, the actual devices that you guys are going to be using in your everyday life. And then from experiment to existence proof. And then from speculation to common sense. And from experiment to existence proof, it's both in the capital market sense of the word and in the scientific sense of the word. And speculation throughout all of history is something that's endogenous to the system. So no matter what people say, that there's hype and there's hyperbole, that's not something that is relegated just to nanotechnology. This was a chart from 50 years ago about what a computer would look like today. This is a prediction. And as you saw in Ray's case yesterday, that there's an enormous fallacy of history of errors in fallacies in the prediction markets of these types of things. The most notable feature of this prediction, if it hasn't jumped out at you already, is the steering wheel on the computer. And I actually noted this in a recent IBM ad that they, I guess, were going back to their roots. Here's an interesting analogy. I like to invoke a lot of biological analogies in how we invest in finding universal laws of nature. From the time that your children were born or you were born, so about age 3 or 4, you have an exponential increase in the number of neurons and synaptic connections in the brain. And then there's this very precipitous pruning process where it drops very suddenly, and then they're, you know, genetically defined and environmentally influenced behavioral patterns, speech patterns, motor functions evolve from birth till young age. It turns out that in any industry, that exact same analogy holds true. So if you look at the personal computing industry, instead of neurons, substituting a number of firms, and you have an exponential increase in the number of firms that enter into a field, and then a precipitous drop-off of the ones that can survive in the ecosystem. The automobile industry had the same characteristics. The television industry, both in color and in black and white, and in the U.S. and the U.K. This is a universal phenomenon across all fields of innovation. Now, this is a little bit of a different chart, but the relative strength of U.S. nylon firms, which essentially reads DuPont, had the fundamental patents for nylon, its integration, its composition of matter, and applications. And it had this kind of stranglehold on that market, which would go on to be $15 billion product for them. Does anybody know, by the way, one of the interesting derivative effects of nylon? Well, it turns out that once you had nylon, you had clear stockings, and it created a behavioral shift. And that behavioral shift was in women, and it was a big boon to Gillette. That's a true story, that women began shaving their legs more. High-ability firms enter earlier and survive longer, and the higher the ability and the larger the firm and their size and profit. So, you know, there's an inspiration you'll hear later from tonight from Andy Kessler, and he wrote an op-ed piece, which I think is brilliant, in the Washington Journal, called We Think They Sweat. And there's this idea, in a sense, as I interpreted it, that the design aspect was more valuable than the manufacturing aspect. And that was reflected in the margins, in the amount of dollars that came back in the capital markets, and so on. So I like this idea that designs are more valuable than manufacturing. And this why this earlier hypothesis, the people that own the fundamental patents and the IP and are able to commercialize those are the winners. Paul Rollmer, Stanford economist, I think has a brilliant insight that says that growth comes from new combinations of fixed resources. And if you look at the periodic table, and we kind of treat the periodic table sometimes to the chagrin of our portfolio company CEOs as a roulette wheel, betting largely on group 4, 3, 5, 2, 6 semiconductors, at least in our most recent funds. If you look at something like iron, ferrous oxide, as a pigment in cave paintings, this is a mechanism to store information thousands of years ago. Same fundamental material. Now let's think about how we can take that same, those same atoms and molecules and combine them into more valuable ways, and that's used as a medium for data storage. If you look at silicon, from sand to glass to an ingot to pentium, more economic value per unit of raw material. Now, if you think about the combinatorial possibilities, and this is not really fully scientifically accurate, but just for demonstration's sake, the four atoms, any four atoms could combine in about 94 million different ways. And if you kept those in proportion stochastically of less than 10 each, you'd end up with about $330 billion total recipes. If you could come up with 1,000 recipes a day, it would take you a million years to do that, which to me speaks to an opportunity for some of these high-throughput combinatorial chemistry firms that are using software rather than beakers doing things in silico to actually discover new materials and drugs and so forth. So right now you've got lots of experiments that are being financed, but we do think that with better research and information intelligence, you can skew the odds in your favor. These are the 8 ways that I think that you can make money in the space. The first is to decisively improve existing products, the khaki pants, pharmaceuticals. Last week in China, this was an interesting thing that's being done with one of our portfolio companies, which is to take the lotus effect, which is a very holy flower leaf in China, and it has extreme hydrophobic properties. We can reverse engineer those properties and use it in construction materials so that you get self-cleaning glass. And this is actually a picture from Shanghai from a week ago showing what happens when you drop water through this and how it wicks away dirt. The second way that you can make money is power research with tools. So again, look at historic precedents, railroad, internet, and so forth, and sell the people that are getting all the capital the tools that they need to compete. One of Ray's charts on the 5 paradigm shifts, you can create new products, and you can think about, again, what that next paradigm will be I think you hear from Matrix tomorrow about three-dimensional memory, and other people have invoked the analogy of being able to compute with individual molecules. Ray may have mentioned this last night as well, the idea that if you add up all of the transistors globally since the invention of the transistor, that if you were to think about computing with individual molecules, there are more molecules in a single droplet of water than there are transistors cumulatively in the world since the invention of the transistor. And you can think that there's just 40 million transistors in my computer alone. So the computational capacity of that invoked, you know, some of the disregarded anecdotes of Bill Gates and others that say at most we'll need 640 kilobits of power, of memory. This is some work from China where they're integrating solid-state lighting, and they're moving very rapidly, and I would say that they're ahead of the U.S. in this regard. On the capital equipment side, you can look at all the tools that are used today in semiconductor equipment manufacturing, and we think that the losers will be people in EUV and the winners will be people in nano imprint. I talked a little bit about the ripple effect from companies like Nanotech and people that are negatively impacted and people that can use that as a positive branding opportunity as well. And then the large-scale platform shift. I'll just talk about these two companies very quickly. What Nanosys does is make new forms of molecules and compound semiconductors that never existed before, whether it's quantum dots or nanowires or tetrapods. Then they take those, they assemble them, and they own the patents for the assembly of those things into novel structures, and then they integrate them into end devices that we will use or industrial partners will use, from solar cells to fuel cells to flexible electronics, clear pieces of plastic that have transistors embedded on them, which cannot be done in a state-of-the-art semiconductor facility today. You get something that looks like roll-to-roll electronics manufacturing. You get the performance of silicon without having to use a wafer. You get lightweight, flexible electronics, and the form factor can then be changed into all kinds of creative things, and that will ultimately impact advertising and textiles and so forth. Their business model is to partner. So they say, okay, we're going to go after all of these different fields. We're going to partner with DuPont and Sharp and Intel and the CIA through their venture arm and SAIC. And we're going to partner with the government and get lots of money from all the taxpayers. And we're going to create these nanomodules. The partner never gets to see the intellectual property. They only get an end deliverable. And end-user products, be it flexible displays, be it embedded solar panels and roofing tiles, be it memory that is both optical and electronic. And the interesting thing about their model is that you get this platform where you can just take this and go any connection, any combination of these pathways to get different applications. So if you go this way, you get a solar cell, from synthesis to assembly to interface to the final format and the final application. If you go this way, you get an RFID tag, and there's all kinds of other applications that you can think of. The final thing that I'll show you is Cambrios, which uses biology to manufacture electronics. The inspiration for this came from reverse engineering the abalone shell. The researcher, Dr. Angela Belcher, who is a MacArthur Genius Award winner, said we can take biology, find the genes that code for proteins that collect sea salt that make this very hard structure, but instead of using sea salt in organic crystals, we can use semiconductors. So we take advantage of evolution and the genetic modifications thereof to actually control electronic and semiconductor materials. These are all of the materials that we now have fundamental biological control over in the company called Cambrios, invoking the idea of Cambrian explosion of possibilities in the material world. This is a photograph showing gallium arsenide and an insulator that is precisely manufactured using these bacteriophage viruses that assemble electronics. And the very final thing that I'll talk about is the environmental impact. There was a county of California which I think probably rightly banned a substance called DHMO. And these are some of the activist posters saying, you know, you have to ban this material, dihydrogen monoxide, it kills, it causes bloating and nausea, electrical short circuits, billions of dollars of property damage, and disaster and destruction. It's found in cancer tumors and cult rituals. How many people, based on what I just described, would also vote to at least regulate this molecule, if not outright ban it? Some of the snickers are giving away the punchline here. Dihydrogen monoxide, if you break out the nomenclature, is dihydrogen, H2, monoxide O, H2O, it's water. And the county of California actually banned, at least for a week, water until they had severe egg on their face. There's always a trade-off in new technologies, be it gasoline, be it radiation-based technologies, fire, automobiles. If I told you that next year there would be an industry that would employ tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people around the world, it would create billions of dollars in revenue, but it would inevitably and almost statistically to the T, kill 50,000 people next year. Most people would say we should ban this, but it is the automobile industry. And just by the law of large numbers and statistical probabilities, that will happen next year. 50,000 people will die from the use of a car. So there are always trade-offs. You try to make sure that the benefits exceed the risks, and I think that's the case. The idea of using nanotechnology in poor countries, from the ideas of C.K. Prahalad, of selling to the rich and living with the poor, or selling to the poor and living with the rich, in a sense, nanomarkets or micro-markets that you can sell scent items to. Procter & Gamble is doing this with a nanomaterial combination of iron sulfate and chlorine, which they believe is a $1 billion opportunity to help reduce dysentery in the third world. Hewlett-Packard is doing the same type of thing using solar energy and nanotechnology. And there's a whole slew of applications, which we won't have time for. But thank you very much for the time.
We've relied on the government a bit too much, and there's turmoil at the FDA, and Scott Gottlieb is not appearing, unfortunately. So we will go directly to the break, and then we will have our panel after the break. Thank you.
Want to pull this? Hey, you got lucky though. At least you got an extra half an hour.
Yeah. Should I go over
the
half hour
too? Yeah, see that count, that counts up and tells you when the time remaining. So when it starts counting up, then you know you're going over.
Rich makes fun of me. He's like, I know you go over on your half.